Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon, which is our final episode of 2023. I'm really pleased to have as my guest for lunch Dr. Nick Reed. Nick runs Reed Mobility, but previously he's been the Academy Director at TRL, the UK's leading research centre for transport, and he's been Head of Mobility R&D for the world's largest automotive supplier, which is Bosch. Nick now runs Reed Mobility, and he's really involved with connected and automated vehicles. He's fascinated and dedicated to improving road safety, taking into account psychology and human factors. I was really pleased to catch up with Nick and talk about some of the things that we had been doing both separately and together.
Well, Nick, we met because of the project that was undertaken on the back of the Rhys Jeffries Road Fund 150th anniversary competition. So I've been a trustee at Rhys Jeffries for some time. For those people who don't know, 150 years ago, William Rhys Jeffries left us, in today's money, £7 million. And with that money, each year we do a few good things, including bursaries for transport planning students and also for really good projects. For the 150th anniversary, we raised the bar a bit. And so welcome, Nick, because you were the winner.
Yeah, one of two winners. And it was brilliant because the competition was really reflected Rhys Jeffries as the inspirational character that he was. Someone who saw, I mean, roads can be demonized, right? And often aren't, sometimes rightly so, but Rhys Jeffries saw the societal value that roads bring. And the competition was about what do the next 50 years look like? How will we be using our roads in 50 years' time? And the project I proposed envisaged a world where automated vehicles were a common feature of those roads that enabled us to use the roads safely, effectively, efficiently, accessibly. But in order to do that, we need to make sure that they behave in line with societal expectations. And I think that's something that's been missing in the rush to get this technology ready and deployed. The companies doing it haven't done enough to engage with society to understand what people want from this technology. So my project was about how we might be able to do that, speak to people and understand their fears, expectations around how automated vehicles are going to serve the communities into which they're deployed.
And so what was the outcome, Nick, of the research?
Well, we held a survey for 2,000 people where we were asking them lots of different about lots of different scenarios, presenting them with statements and rating their, getting them to rate their agreement with those statements. An example might be a self-driving vehicle is overtaking a cyclist. Should the vehicle leave more space for the cyclist, increasing the risk of collision with the oncoming traffic, or go down the middle? And we're looking at how people rated their agreement with those statements. But each statement was associated with one or more of eight values. And they were road safety for passengers, safety of other road users, the extent to which the vehicle improves mobility for people, their trust in the operation of the vehicles, the legality of operation of the vehicles, cost of operation, urban design, and fairness. And using those categories, we were able to understand which of those values people prioritized. And the thing that came out most strongly in those, in the survey, was trust. And I think trust is formed by perceptions of safety, which came out equally for passengers and other road users. People recognized the equality of safety there, but also the importance of a legal framework. So people wanted there to be a process by which liabilities would be understood, and also a process that would enable us to learn from each incident that happened. So when a crash happens, we get the data and we can find ways to make sure that sort of incident doesn't happen again.
Very exciting. Well, it's funny you should say it, Nick. One of my party piece speaking things is when I'm talking to an audience about autonomous vehicles, I always pose the question, if outside all these vehicles are autonomous, are you going to press the button and wait for the green man before you cross the road? or are you going to walk out in front of the traffic because you know it's going to stop for you anyway? And those are the sorts of societal changes that we have to think about, don't we, with autonomous vehicles, because the way in which we interact with them as humans is going to be quite different to the way in which we interact with vehicles that are driven by humans. You know, and I'm a fan of autonomous vehicles because without doubt they will be safer than what we currently have. Let's face it, we kill 4 or 5 people a day here in the United Kingdom with conventional vehicles, which is outrageous. If that happened in any other possible place of work or location, the owners would go to jail. Yet we do get, don't we, anytime a Tesla on autopilot has an accident, it's front page news. But it's never front page news when ordinary people just get killed by conventional motoring, which of course is shocking because it's a terrible price to pay for the freedom that motoring gives us. So I'm a fan of autonomous vehicles because of the improved safety factor. It has to be better than we have at the moment.
Yes. And a wrinkle on that, Leon, is that the crashes that self-driving vehicles may have will happen for very different reasons than they happen for human drivers. And will juries, society, your court of public opinion accept technology making errors that would have been easily avoidable for a human driver, but that's for some bizarre confluence of factors has resulted in the self-driving vehicle doing something unexpected? So they certainly have to be safer than human driving, but they'll have to behave in ways that are acceptable to the public as well.
Indeed. Any other surprises from your research? Were the things that you didn't expect?
So the second part of the study was workshops. So it wasn't just the survey. We then had in-depth workshops with members of the public who came into the Smart Mobility Living Lab, TRL's facility in Woolwich, where we hosted these workshops. And we could get into more depth about some of the interesting scenarios that cropped up in the survey. And I think it's one of the limitations of the project is we could really get a sense of the extent to which people understood how this technology worked. And to get people to discuss the scenario in the right way, we could spend the time getting everyone up to the same broad level of understanding. Because people have very different preconceptions about what a self-driving vehicle might be. Their experience might be having seen a Herbie movie 40, 50 years ago, or Knight Rider, or something completely different. So getting people to understand exactly what this technology is and how it will work and the thought that's gone into how safely they will operate was an important part of it. And I think the next step for this work is to use something like simulation or virtual reality to present scenarios to participants and then get them to decide whether the scenario they've seen in a virtual environment was acceptable or not. And then they could adjust the parameters of that scenario to a point at which they're happy. You know, the closeness of passing a pedestrian or a cyclist, or pulling out to allow an emergency vehicle to pass, adjusting those parameters. And what that will do is give automated vehicle developers kind of real objective evidence on how they should optimize the behavior of their vehicles. And it will also give the regulators tools to say, well, this is the sort of performance we expect from you. Why aren't we seeing that out in the real world? So that, I think that's where we intend to go next with the research.
Very interesting. It also, when I talk to people about autonomous vehicles, especially the skeptics, they are, of course, thinking about automating what we currently have. Christian Wolmar famously not only wrote the book on the subject of why autonomous vehicles will never happen, but he broadcasted at every opportunity, including on this show. But he clearly raises the questions about what happens when two autonomous vehicles meet each other in a narrow piece of road. But this presupposes existing vehicles no longer needing a driver on existing roads, which isn't necessarily the whole story here, because combined with zero emission, there's no reason why, for example, you wouldn't have traffic, say, in a department store or in a shopping precinct, because it's us that's narrowing this to vehicles driving on the carriageway, which is part of a roadway, which is shared with pedestrians But in fact, autonomous vehicles won't necessarily be limited to conventional highways. And it's no different, is it, to those little trains that run around the theme park or the sort of robo-taxis that you might get on, say, university campus or so on. So I think we spoil the discussion by simply thinking about automating the existing traffic, because that's only half the story, I reckon.
Yeah. I love Christian. And in all honesty, you know, I've been positive about the benefits of automated vehicles for more than a decade. But have grown increasingly skeptical. And I think we have a lot in common, actually, in the things we think will need to happen for these vehicles to be deployed safely. The challenge back to the skeptics is it is happening at the moment. Waymo have deployed vehicles in multiple cities operating in complex urban environments. I went to San Francisco this summer myself, saw it. It's a completely mundane experience. You wait 2 minutes on a street corner and you will see one of these vehicles coming by, whether it's Waymo, Cruise, or Zooks, or WeRide, or any number of developers that have technology that they're testing and deploying in that environment. So it is happening. The experience with Cruise over the last few weeks and months, with the incident that happened in October, them not necessarily sharing the data and information about the incident that they should have with the authorities, the resignation of the CEO, all of that stuff stems from, I think, the issue that was covered in this Rhys Jeffries project, is not engaging with society enough about how the vehicle should behave. And there's lots of, even when I was over in San Francisco, there were tensions between the public and the vehicle developers, a group placing traffic cones on these vehicles to stop their operation, to indicate that they felt they were a hazard. I think if the companies had done more to engage with society and to understand the potential benefits, the risks as well, understand the risks of what's being deployed, but make sure that's in the context of the risks that exist today with human-driven vehicles, they could have avoided some of the problems that have happened this year.
Lunch with Leon, in association with Passenger Transport magazine. Check out passengertransport.co.uk.
I'm running a bit of a theory that the first place in the UK will probably see this, aside from university campuses and special areas like that, is in the suburban low-level railhead, picking up the effectively people coming off their train commute into a place that's low density, low public transport penetration, and where the existing taxi service is either non-existent or too expensive, or a combination of both. And it seems to me that Oxford Street is not the most obvious place to start with autonomous vehicles. And given that we're not going to start with anywhere to anywhere via everywhere capability, we're going to start with limited capability in an area. I can imagine this will crop up in low density outer suburb type areas, where frankly, if you've had a couple of drinks or been out for dinner and you get back at 10:30 at night, you've either got an expensive taxi ride or a not very pleasant walk in order to go home. And that's where I'd expect it to pop up, because that's a bit of a vacuum in terms of public transport provision. So I'm in the robo taxi, super taxi, outer suburb area for the first real proper use of adding something to what we have.
I think that's right, for a vehicle that is designed only to be used without a driver. The other element that is coming is very near term, is vehicles that will do the driving for you in some circumstances. And with my other hat on, my National Highways Chief Road Safety Advisor hat, thinking about advanced vehicles that have an automated capability on highways, but then hand control back to the driver when they leave the highway, is something that's very, very important to us, making sure that they're deployed safely, that the implications of their operation are well understood, particularly if the driver is ready to resume control. And what happens when the driver isn't ready to resume control? What happens to the vehicle then? Does it choose to stop in a live lane? That clearly is something we'd be very concerned about. So yeah, I agree with your use case. I like the sound of it. Also concerned about the vehicles that might appear on highways soon as well.
Sure. And what you're describing is, of course, the iterative process we've had ever since we've had dynamic cruise control, lane keeping assist, lane change, and so on, because to some extent, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, I have all of those on my car switched in as much of the time as is humanly possible. Interesting sensation. I find myself more like the pilot monitoring than the pilot flying. So I'm sat, possibly with my hands on my knees, looking around a lot, but letting the car do all of the work. And frankly, those assistance features are normal on a lot of modern vehicles. Now, what's different is how and when people use them. I just happen to be at the end of the scale, but the moment there's at least one white line in my view, I've got the whole thing switched on and letting it do all the work, because I know as long as there's a decent white line, it'll find it. I like that enormously. I definitely find I am less stressed and more relaxed at the end of any journey. And I also find that I'm more alert because I'm doing the monitoring, because I'm poised to take control back at a millisecond's notice. So I'm vigilant. I'm looking around. I am checking the readings. I am looking at the controls. I'm thinking about what we should be doing compared with what we are doing, all of those things. So frankly, what you're describing is the next generation of that, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's interesting you describe it that way, Leon, because the automated bus trials that are happening in Scotland, the trials called CAV 4th and an extension to it there, they describe the safety operator in the vehicle as the bus captain. So they're as exactly as you described, they're monitoring the systems and ready to resume control. But in ultimately, when the system has been fully tested and deployed, that bus captain might have more of a passenger care role than a driving role. And so they can, you know, take care of the needs and expectations of their bus passengers rather than have to be tied to the steering wheel. The way you've described the situation, you're clearly a very diligent driver. Others may not be quite so, as in if the vehicle is doing the driving or appears to be, other drivers may be tempted to not pay attention, to start to do other things. The smartphone is laser guided to grab our attention whenever we're not attending to it. So there's certainly distraction will be a factor. And so driver monitoring will have to become more of a feature that to make sure that drivers are paying attention suitably in the context of these partially automated systems.
Sure. Well, when I was working with the team at 5AI, which is now part of Bosch, definitely some work. Under what circumstances you give the driver back full control? And we did quite a bit of research from aviation, where, of course, the system is designed to do just that. The autopilot will do everything for you under normal circumstances, but there are some conditions when it'll tell you it's going to drop out and drops out and gives it back to you. We found quite a bit of interesting research there about, if you like, the pilot monitoring being ready to become the pilot flying. The other bit of the technical work I was fascinated about that we had seen at 5AI was that the artificial intelligence itself could spot the difference between a live human and a mannequin in John Lewis's window, because they look broadly the same. It was sensitive enough to be able to distinguish between real humans and things that looked like humans, which I thought was extraordinary. But in any conversation you have with anybody, you immediately get into this argument about, does it kill the child or the old lady? Which is a sort of ridiculous argument, because there's no suggestion that this equipment is going to make value for money decisions based on the economic capacity of the choice, because the choice is rarely that binary anyway, and that's not its job. Its job is to drive safely without hitting anybody, and it will do all it can to avoid hitting anybody. So they're the sort of arguments you get from people around the dinner table who think it's fun to argue against all form of progress.
It's interesting because the Rhys Jeffries project has its origins essentially in that dinner table argument. The origin of the project ultimately was from work I did for the European Commission, creating recommendations on the ethics of connected and automated vehicles. And I think that working group was stimulated by a Nature paper called The Moral Machine, an MIT study, which did a lot of these trolley-type scenarios. And it was a very interesting paper, but it wasn't necessarily about how to build safe automated vehicles. It was about how humans value life and make that kind of decision. But it got a huge amount of coverage and led to this working group. The first agenda point in the working group meetings was, we're not going to talk about trolley dilemmas. We're going to talk about the real ethical issues of the development and deployment of automated vehicles, one of which around safety was around rule compliance and how automated vehicles would manage situations that human drivers do, where they bend or sometimes even break the rules of the road for reasons of safety. And enabling a vehicle to do that in an ethical way is what we were trying to get to with our project. It's about creating what we called ethical goal functions. The idea that you have a mathematical framework that the vehicle optimizes in order to behave safely and ethically and in line with the expectations of society. And that's where we've got to. We've developed the priorities for that ethical goal framework, and now we need to do more to develop it further.
Sure. And you got an award, I think, from the Rhys Jeffries project.
Yes. So delighted that the project received the research award for the first ever self-driving industry awards that were announced last week. So yeah, delighted that the idea won the funding from Rhys Jeffries to deliver the project. And then the project itself won the research award in the self-driving industry awards. So yeah, really, really thrilled with that.
Well, congratulations.
And hopefully that is
on that.
The platform for future research as well.
Congratulations, absolutely, on that. It's good to see that sort of recognition. Something else which I'm fascinated about, it's something you referenced earlier, because it's another project that you did. This is about the distraction of mobile phones to drivers. And I think we all feel superhuman, that we can glance at the phone, we can find the keyboard, we can do some key presses and send messages that say I'm going to be late or whatever, which is only a half a step away from listening to the radio, which is only another half a step away from watching a video. So tell me some more about the project that you did on that, on the mobile phone distraction.
Wow. Yeah. So that was work I did whilst at TRL. Looked at a huge range of different types of distractor for human drivers, whether it's conversation, whether it was drink, fatigue, diet. We looked at the effects of diet on driving performance. But perhaps the study that got the most attention was the effect of texting on driving behavior. So it's feels quite old now to be talking about texting, but it got a lot of coverage at the time to really illustrate the effects of texting and driving and the effect on reaction time, and particularly on the ability to stay in the lane on a series of bends. We were able to monitor very accurately how well you could keep to the center of the road, and the performance was hopeless when trying to text at the same time. So yeah, really quantifying that impact of texting and driving. It's interesting, you know, now the in-vehicle systems are getting more integrated, the likes of Apple CarPlay and Android Auto offering more and more functionality. And as you say, it's only one step removed from altering the radio, but it is definitely different at a cognitive level. The amount of engagement required to operate some of these functions is borderline. And I think this is where we're getting into the realm of needing that driver monitoring function to be able to understand, was the driver paying sufficient attention? And certainly some of the incidents with Teslas, with the Uber test vehicle that had a crash, you could see that inattention of the person at the controls was a key factor in those crashes happening. So yeah, the need for driver monitoring is pressing.
Indeed. When I used to run buses, we did quite a lot of work with groups of staff. It's the usual thing, you know, take people off the road for the day, tell them about the company, tell them about the world, tell them about what's going to happen. And I brought in somebody and they started talking to the bus drivers about nutrition and hydration and posture and soft tissue damage and all the stuff that you might imagine. And it was breathtaking, because without in any way trying to generalize on bus drivers, but people certainly didn't understand that they needed to keep their sugar level up. So they would come out early in the morning, low in the cycle, not get breakfast. And unsurprisingly, after a couple of hours at the wheel, their attention span had really fallen. And hadn't thought about fruit or orange juice or whatever. It was all very, very unusual. And then we got to this thing about posture, because bus drivers are, I'm afraid, notorious for slouching. And that in turn added pain and difficulties to their whole skeletal system. And it was absolutely revealing. And I'm afraid it's too long ago now to be able to quote any data. But it was amazing that people thought they could function at 100% in a tough job without nutrition, without hydration, without rest, and that we didn't even get near worrying about their credit card bills or their relationships or anything like that. And the one thing that gave it away is a very high proportion of our low bridge accidents took place on the empty journey back to the garage at the end of the day.
Right.
And it was, of course, that people had professionally filled their brain with their duties during the course of the day and fulfilled those, you know, driven safely, carried passengers, taken the money, done all the things supposed to do. But on the way home, back to the garage, the rest of the pressures in their life started to fill their brain. As they approached the end of their shift, they were starting to think again about trouble at home or trouble at children. And those low bridge accidents were happening because their professional vigilance was coming down and the rest of their world was starting to take over again. It became a very strong thing for us about making sure that people stayed focused right till the end.
Yeah, and professional drivers on the whole are very good, but they do so much driving that they do experience risks that everyday people who don't necessarily drive for work don't experience in the same way. And the work we did on diet was inspired by the bump there is in serious collisions after in the period after lunch between 2 and 4 o'clock.
Oh, really?
Exactly as you described, that sugar dip. And we did a trial where drivers had a heavy lunch and a low glycemic index lunch. And the difference was palpable. You know, you could see fewer yawns, better attention, more consistent driving. Yeah, really, really fascinating study. And you know, apply that in the work context where the employer has a duty of care to their employee. I think it's a really fascinating, important topic.
No, indeed. And I have to say, the big assumption by the professional drivers was that they could be at peak capability regardless of all of those extraneous factors, the nutrition, hydration, sleep, etc. And they were absolutely amazed to learn that they weren't. And hopefully those lessons and that a little bit of education we gave them saved a few bang scrapes and hopefully saved injuries and deaths. The other one that was fascinating for me, every time in London when we had the HGV versus cyclist collision, where in fatality terms, it was always between about 12 and 14 a year. People flooded into my office saying, here's a great invention. We've invented these sensors. And if these sensors detect an impending collision, it'll slam the brakes on. And my argument always was, no. The driver, we cannot take away from the driver his responsibility. I don't mind you warning him, but he has to put the brakes on. And they would always argue, why wouldn't you let the machine do that? Well, because then the driver will just drive like hell and rely on the automated system to stop him if something's going to happen. And I don't want to take away that responsibility. I want him to have that responsibility. So I'm happy for him to be warned. I'm not going to have him effectively overridden.
Yes. Yeah, I was involved in some of the research TfL commissioned on such systems. Again, lots of whizzy gadgets that offered warnings, fitting beacons to bikes, for instance. And the concern always is, what about the bike that doesn't have that? The driver gets used to being warned when there's one of these bikes with beacons, doesn't then check the mirror to see that there's someone on a regular bike without such a beacon or a smartphone system. Yeah, you just need to make sure the driver has the tools to make the decisions for themselves in the safest possible way. Yeah.
Well, Nick, this is amazing. Believe it or not, we've been talking for over half an hour and it feels like 10 minutes, which shows we must have been enjoying ourselves. So this has been fascinating. I'm delighted to hear about the award and the work that you did following the Rhys Jeffries competition, but also all the other work that you are doing and have been doing and are indeed famous for. I don't know what it is. The older I get, the more interested in technology I become. I don't know why that is. Maybe I have less of the future to look forward to than I used to. So maybe that's why I'm excited about all these technological developments. But I'm especially excited about the fact that it will improve safety and reduce collisions and, in general, make the whole random movement of people and machines easier, more efficient and safer and so on. So congratulations on all you're doing, Nick. And really thank you very much for being a guest.
Thank you, Leon. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, look, so this has been Lunch with Leon, which is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. You'll find Nick at read-mobility.co.uk, and you'll find Passenger Transport Magazine at passengertransport.co.uk. I've really enjoyed talking to Nick Reed on the show today. Thanks very much indeed for joining us, Nick, and good luck in all you're doing.
Thank you, Leon.